got Eddie Schwartz, who's with Nationwide, the Vice President and Chief Information Security Officer for Nationwide Insurance. I'd sing their theme song, but
go ahead.
I'm not in a shower, and I don't think anybody wants to hear me. They don't.
It would be nice. Eddie they could do really a little don't. Dance. And
They really don't.
You never know.
Okay, we've combined the talks because they've taken a look at their talks and felt it should be combined. So this will be like a part one and a part two talk. Thank you.
Great. Hi, I'm Eddie Schwartz, and this is my partner, Diana. What we decided to do, we got together and figured out that our talks had some overlap, and what we decided to do is focus in this session initially on the business drivers associated with privacy, that being the consumer issues, regulatory pressures, things like the FTC, recent Treasury Department regulations, things like that, healthcare regulations, and talk about the actual impacts that impose risk and risk which we as security officers are tasked to deal with. The second part of the presentation is where we're going to focus more on the actual risk mitigation. What's the work plan to get through all this privacy stuff? What's an approach that you can take back and apply just about anywhere in the organization, whether you're going to apply it, you know, as a CIO to your IT organization, you're going to try to convince management to get on board with an actual methodology they can follow in some way, or that you just want to know, as a security person, what the heck should I be doing to get this under control? So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Diana to get it started.
Thanks. Yeah, it was interesting. We just met each other last week, and the way we met was that Eddie was going over the Black Hat site and said, "Hey, we're doing almost the same talk." And I said, "Nah," but we were. So it's actually a good fit. And I do apologize to anybody who read the schedule, and I hope nobody comes into the next missing out on some of these good background things. But it's a very good fit because I come from a consulting and services background. So I was actually going into companies, helping them look at their privacy issues and building a framework and getting this through the organization. And Eddie's coming up from inside the organization and seeing how it plays out. So
actually having to do it and deal with it and deal with all the complications of it.
You've got two good sides of the house. Again, this is really, we're focusing on policy to technology. I am going to cover the policies. I will be going on the background of HIPAA and GLBA, but which is, you'll hear about what they are during the talk. We are not lawyers, and that is one thing to keep in mind. Privacy is a very legal kind of thing. We aren't lawyers. We don't play them on TV. So just as a background, if there are some big legal questions, issues that get raised, we wouldn't be able to answer them. We're technologists. So we are talking about privacy, and I think it's a pretty important, if you go back and you think about healthcare, and if you even dive into the Hippocratic Oath, you can see, you know, whatever I see or hear which ought not to be spoken of abroad, I will not divulge, which is the basis of privacy, and privacy has been very important since 400 BC to healthcare. Again, here's just the agenda. We are going to talk a little bit about what privacy is. People have very different ideas about privacy and very different definitions, so we'll cover that briefly. We will talk about the regulations and some backgrounds and then some impacts, basically the why you should care. And then in the next, after the break, we'll be coming back and going into the actual how you get to the implementation point. And do you have to read your disclaimer? This is actually a Nationwide disclaimer.
So. Well, the disclaimer is that what we're going to present in the second part is an actual how to do it guide that anybody can follow to get this area under control. I've been fortunate enough to be involved in this space for a couple of years and actually have developed a methodology. However, the disclaimer is that that methodology represents in no way opinions of my company, and it does not provide any recommendations or even potentially indicate any practices that we may or may not follow. And there were some other legal things that I took out, but you understand the disclaimer, so.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. So you got that? Okay. Nicholas Negroponte said, "Everything on the web is ultimately about trust," which is not quite privacy, but this is about trust, and privacy is about, in a large way, about trust. If you go back, the last 100 years, even more than the 400 BC that we had there from Hippocrates, privacy is not new. Invasions of your privacy, it's not new. It happened before. It's going to happen again. People, you know, the paparazzi's always been out there. There have been gossip, tabloids, yellow journalism. People have gone into privacy realm before. The difference now is that there's no time and distance. It's not physically separated anymore. Somebody can get to you digitally from all over the world at any time of day or night and exploit that data and persist that data and aggregate and reuse that data. So it has shifted slightly, although privacy invasion's definitely not new. I don't know if you want to add anything to that. You just hop in.
Well, I'll just add one thing.
We've never talked together.
You mentioned the quote about the trust. When I started at Nationwide, I met with the CEO like the first week I was there, and he really didn't know what, you know, a chief security officer would do or why they were even hiring me exactly. But what he did say to me is he said, you know, the most important thing to me is our brand image and the trust that people put in that brand. And he said he was really concerned about the internet and how that might erode the perception of customers that they should trust us in some way. And that was good because I had privacy on my mind when I went to talk to him. So I think, you know, even though trust and privacy are different things, he kind of equated the two. And it made a lot of sense to me in terms of how he sees what's important to the business, you know.
And Scott McNeely obviously has a good bottom line there. You have zero privacy, so just get over it. I basically think of privacy is the information gravy train out there with marketers and with other companies. I mean, they're not going out to invade your privacy. They don't want to invade your privacy because they're malicious. They're looking at it as a way to cross-sell, upsell. It's the information gravy train. That's what they're looking at and getting the information on there. Again, distances are irrelevant. This whole Big Brother fear within consumers has really led to a firestorm of privacy concern among people. They're worried about the government stepping in. They're worried about companies stepping in. There have been some really interesting things going on in Michigan. Jennifer Granholm, the district attorney, the attorney general, sorry, in Michigan, a couple months ago, stopped a merger between two companies. I'm not sure if you're aware of Abacus and DoubleClick. Is anybody familiar with them? DoubleClick does a clickstream tracking on the web. You're going, yeah, I know them. Yeah, yeah. Well, do you know what Abacus is? Okay. Ha. Okay, Abacus is the company that, have you ever had, a lot of times they'll ask you what's your zip code out there at a retailer, or have you ever purchased anything? You get one catalog in the mail from Smith & Hawken or Pottery Barn, and you buy, and you know, then maybe a year later you get another catalog. But finally one day you buy something from that catalog, and all of a sudden, whoosh, you get catalogs from all these different vendors. That's because a company called Abacus was aggregating your data and sending you out new bits of information. Well, so Abacus was tracking people in the real world at stores and through catalogs. DoubleClick was tracking what people were doing over the internet. DoubleClick bought Abacus a few months ago, and they wanted to get together and aggregate that data so that they could learn about what you were doing on the web and what you were doing on the land. And the Attorney General of Michigan, Jennifer Granholm, stepped in and said, yeah, I don't think so, guys. Let's stop this for a little while. Because there is a firestorm. There is a big concern with folks about getting that.
The other issue recently, if you've seen a lot of these dot-coms are going bankrupt, I guess the stock price drop through the floor. One of the things you may have seen is ToySmart, and basically they had a customer database, you know, including information on the ages of children and so on, and basically they wanted to go and sell that database as part of their bankruptcy procedures. The FTC stepped in and obviously stopped them from doing that, but we're going to see more and more issues where ToySmart may have had a privacy policy posted on their website. Something happens, and unfortunately, bankruptcy law would allow them potentially to do this. This is very bad, obviously, and I'm sure you as consumers wouldn't find that very appealing if you had agreed to do business with them under certain terms, and then they go and breach those terms later on for other reasons, and you don't have a say in it, basically.
Again, privacy is something that people have very different definitions for. They're slippery definitions. They're shifting around. Privacy itself has gotten very, very political in the past few months. Marketing has one idea of it. Technical folks tend to think of privacy as, hey, doesn't that mean it's encrypted over the wire? is not privacy. But now, you know, personal people, you know, personally, you have an idea of what's your privacy. Is somebody looking in your window? That kind of thing. So I put up here the American Society for Testing and Materials, and they do definitions. They're a definition company, group. And they have privacy as the right of the individual to be left alone. Confidentiality is the responsibility for limiting the disclosure of private matters. And security is the means to control, access, and protect. You can take those definitions or not if they have value for you. A lot of people who are working with privacy right now do, though, refer to the ASTM definitions, which is why I'm sharing them with you now. We're going to go into...
I was just going to say an important subpoint for security people on this is that, why do security people care about privacy? Well, because we are a significant enabler for the success of a privacy program. In terms of these definitions, I mean, that's one of the things you want to take home to your, whoever you work for, is that you can't do privacy if you don't have this enabler in place.
Yeah, I sort of laugh. A lot of people, when I was at the Big Five consulting firm, a lot of people would say, so what's the privacy killer app? What's the tool? What's the privacy tool? P3P? Is that going to be it? Is that going to solve all the problems? No. There's no silver bullet for privacy. And really, if you're very familiar with security, you can see that the ways that privacy ultimately will be implemented technically are a lot of the tools that we have been using as security professionals for years and years and years. There's not a lot of brand new bells and whistles. A lot of the stuff that's coming through is legally related, policy related. But when it gets down to how are you protecting data on a machine, it's encryption. We know that. How are we striating responsibility and keeping data separate on a machine? We've been doing that with trusted operating systems. There's not a big privacy solution. One privacy software, buy it off the shelf and you're private. You want to do your lexicon?
Sure. Part of what you need to understand in terms of being able to deal with this space is that there are certain core principles that are pretty much pervasive across all of the privacy regulation and different code that's been written. The Europeans certainly are providing leadership in this space because they have very stringent privacy laws in place. But we're starting to see in the U.S. now a lot of federal and state regulation. Most of it centers around these four concepts here. The first concept is notice and awareness. That is, you need to tell the customer what you're doing with their data in some way. And what that means is you actually have to send them a notice or in some way contact them and say, this is what we do with your data. Even if it's, we don't share it with anyone, you need to do that. And then you need to make sure that you're not lying about it, too.
Right, we cover that, and that's part of GLBA is very specific about that, so we'll cover that a little bit later.
The issue of choice and consent, okay, given however you use the information, the consumer should have the right to opt out of the use of that information in the way that you stipulated if they don't want to. So there has to be a mechanism in place where you can say, I don't want you sharing this with anybody else. Please let me... Please stop. You have a question about this?
I was just curious. Do you think that it's going to go the American opt-out method, or is it going to go the European opt-in method, which is that you have to give me permission, I have to give you permission to use my information, as opposed to
definitely.
If I don't tell you.
The question is the U.S. going to go opt-in or opt-out? Because the answer, in my opinion, is that it's going to be opt-in. I mean, that's the world we're heading towards, most definitely. And that's a very key question because...
You think opt-in? You don't think opt-out? I think it's going to be opt-out.
Oh, I think it's going to be opt-in.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. The reason...
Point, well, counterpoint.
We'll talk about this in the second section, but just to digress for a minute, it's a lot harder to, let's say that you say basically everybody, we're not going to use your information in any way unless you say it's okay for us to do it. It's a lot easier to manage that because it's a smaller percentage of people. I think if you basically say we're going to share this with everybody, and then potentially 35% of the population come back and say, no, I don't want you to do that, you've got to manage that those preferences in every single system you have. It depends how you're all organized, but I mean, let's take an insurance company, for example. A customer service rep at an insurance company will open 9 applications sometimes to service a set of policies. Do we have data attributes across all of those applications that in which we can flag those privacy preferences today and have those preferences pervasively be carried across all those databases and systems? The answer is no, we don't. So, you know, the world that we want to live in is one in which it's very simple. You know.
Actually, that's why I think it's going to be opt-out, because the bottom line with opt-out is that I will share your data. That's it. And you have the option to opt out, but I'm going to be sharing your data. So if you don't check, so the retailers or the companies that want to do the info gravy train are going to bet that a lot of people aren't going to even bother checking that opt out box. And then if they do check it, okay, well now I won't be able to use your data. But it's a path of least resistance. It's setting them up to have the data. So that's why I'm going to vote for.
I vote opt in.
Okay, I vote opt out.
All right, you're from Nellisley. Okay, the third issue is security integrity. And this is a key point for all of us here. What things are we doing to make sure that the data on an individual is accurate in nature and that there are security controls surrounding that data, processes, mechanisms of some sort, policies, et cetera. And, you know, a lot of regulation is very vague on this today. We're now getting real regulatory guidance on what constitutes due care in this, and we'll talk about that more later. And finally, enforcement and redress. What do I do if I feel you're not playing with me the right way? You're not being square with me. You're not notifying me. You're not doing what I ask you to do with my data. What recourse do I have? You know, how is that whole thing handled?
Going?
Sure, well, yeah.
Okay, personal identifiable information, that's what we're talking about here. It's something that identifies you uniquely in some way, some combination of your personal attributes, okay? If it were just, let's say, your last name and your age, it might be a little harder to track you than if it was your full name and address, let's say. That would be personally identifiable information. Or your social security number and, you know, some other attribute. There are ways to link these things together.
Yes, you might see it listed as III, individually identifiable information. Sometimes it's referred to in privacy that way.
Three potential choices in what companies would do. Opt out is basically the company has said, I'm sharing your data. If you want me to stop doing it, call me and let me know, and you know, we'll take you out of that. Opt in is basically, we've got all these cool business partners that we want to share your data with, but we're not going to do it unless you say you want to participate in that in some way. So you're opting into the use of that data. Do not share is, we don't share your data, period. And that's a position that we've actually taken in Nationwide, which is we do not share. So
that's good. So now you know, if you're privacy aware, you might want to go to Nationwide. I put in a couple of slides here to just explain to people how things are profiled. Sometimes people don't understand how their privacy or their information is used. A lot of times people feel like, well, they don't understand how a company could actually use it, so they think that it's all right if they give away their information. They say, yeah, you know, I'll definitely, that's fine, you can follow my click streams and you can see what I'm searching for on the web and you can and see that, but and just give me a PC for 55 cents a day. And then maybe later on that information is used in a way that they don't feel comfortable with, and they go, oh, you know, this isn't okay. A good example of something that happened a couple of years ago a year and a half ago now, was CVS Pharmacy. It's a pharmacy that's known more on the East Coast. But what they were doing was they were selling the information of their patients' prescription lists to marketers, direct mail marketers. So say you had a prescription to Accutane and to Retin-A. Well, you know, the folks that sell benzoyl peroxide, which is those are both acne, prescribed for acne. You know, the acne medication people were like, great, so they're sending out coupons for benzoyl peroxide. But people were all of a sudden looking at this or you know, things about, you know, Benecal is coming out, it's going to be good for your heart. It's the guy who's taking the heart medicine. How did they find this out? Well, the consumers got pretty upset because they did not like the idea of some direct marketer knowing what drugs they were taking, which is pretty understandable. No legislation was enacted. The public outcry was so loud and furious that CVS opted to cease and desist by themselves. But it's an example of, you know, what can go on. GLBA itself was brought up in some ways because it's When in 1929, they separated all the financial services and the insurance and the brokerage houses because of the crash. And now everybody gets to converge again. Citigroup was one of the first big conglomerates here in the U.S. But it raised a lot of issues around, well, wait a second. If my insurance company knows that I have a heart condition or I have high cholesterol and I'm going to get a mortgage from that same company, could I be rejected for the mortgage based on my health? If they have the data, it's possible. It is possible. So how do they do all this magic and aggregate? There are a couple different ways that you can profile. One is behavioral data. So you profile how somebody acts in a given situation. That may sound a little strange digitally, but an example that you all have probably experienced is your credit card. Your credit card does heuristics and profiling of how you spend on that card. And when they find something that's very anomalous, they will call you up, or they will potentially stop the card. So if you tend to spend, I had my card stolen a couple years ago, and I didn't know, and I got a call from my credit card company, and they said, are you in Rhode Island right now? And I was at my home in Boston, you know, picked up the phone. Are you in Rhode Island right now charging $1,000 worth of running shoes? And I said, no. I said, okay. So they canceled out the card, but they knew that I didn't go and charge in that particular way. It wasn't even in the amount, because I have charged higher amounts. It was the profile of my behavioral data. So you can digitally learn how somebody acts. A lot of intrusion detection right now, some of it is looking at how people act and learning around that. Also, buying preferences are another thing that can get tracked. You know, Amazon does it to you. They learn what kind of books you like, and then lo and behold, the next time you go, if there's a book along the kind of thing that you're interested in, there it is. In some ways, this is very positive, right? We want our credit card companies to stop misuse on our credit cards. That's a good thing. And maybe you like that Amazon is telling you when something new is coming out. I mean, I had an interesting case where one of the bands I like a lot, one of the members was in another band, and I hadn't known about it, and Amazon knew to tell me. And that was great. But it can also be kind of spooky if you turn around and see how it could be used against you.
Yeah, like their community profiles. You know, if you go on there and you look at some book, and it says, you know, this is the number 2 book at HP this week, or something like that. I mean, I don't know about you, but as a corporate security officer, it bugs me that some company that I didn't authorize is advertising that, you know, all of our employees bought the latest Daniel Steele book or something like that. You know, because first of all, if they're associated with the company when they bought it, they must have bought it on company time, or they somehow tracked it from our, you know, an IP address, or who knows how they did it, you know. That kind of stuff bugs me. I would definitely want to somehow block that, you know, so.
Aggregated data is when they start gathering your data and slicing and dicing it to find new and interesting things about you. The Abacus and Clickstream example was an example of aggregated data. And you can be very active about it. You can opt to release that information on digitally. It can also be pretty passive. Clickstream tracking is one of those. A lot of people don't realize how tracked they are out on the web. And I think that you said there was an example in this book I have written a couple papers on this, and I do walk through an example, and I think that there might be something similar in here, where somebody just goes on the web and starts to track something. Let's say they're depressed, so they start off at an herbal site and read about St. John's warts, and then they go and read something at a psychological site about depression, and then maybe they go to the drugstore and they're out of razor blades, but they buy razor blades. Could somebody link all those together? Yeah, conceivably. I mean, the information can certainly be aggregated. Could somebody make a choice on that and make a decision to come over to your house and ask you about your state of health? Yes, you had a question.
Regarding opt-in, opt-out, is that always with respect to what that information was shared with third parties, or is that just whether it's okay for doing this on the web, contract you, just it counts like these formats?
The clickstream tracking is not really right now much of an opt-out. People are clickstream tracked without sometimes any ability to opt out of it. Opt-in, opt-out generally, though, is going to adhere to whatever policy is posted by that company. So third-party sharing is very often something that's described in certainly financial services, health insurance, that sort of thing. But you don't, you'd have to read whatever company's opt-in, opt-out policy you're adhering to when you...
And try to understand it. Because in our case, I mean, we have an insurance business, many insurance businesses. We have healthcare businesses. We have a business that aggregates disability information from many companies and provides profiling patterns of that aggregate information, including our internal employees. Okay, we have financial services, we have 401k annuities, and so on. Okay, so who is in between companies? How are they allowed to share? Under certain regulations, they're allowed to share certain things, like financial information, under GLB, as long as they're not non-affiliated third parties. Okay, but the healthcare information is not allowed to be shared in terms of PII. When it's two different companies we own. So it's a really complex matrix that you have to deal with. And again, just take it down to the systems level for a second and try to imagine the rules engine to manage where data goes based on all these different rules. Even if you've said, I do not share, in our case, it's we do not share with third parties. Internally, we share a lot.
That's what I'm saying, actually.
Right. The problem with that is you just turning off the click stream. I mean, we talk later about Cookie Pal, for example, or something like that. I mean, you can do that, but I've actually encountered websites that won't do business with you if you don't accept cookies, you know?
Yeah, or they say that you will get functionality on
the site. Right. Yeah, well, I mean, there are anonymizers out there now. Zero Knowledge is a good example, and I wonder how much take they're going to get in the market because of issues like that. Yes? I meant like a drugstore.com site. So, and yes, the click streams, I mean, the way DoubleClick works is that you have a deal with DoubleClick and they're depositing cookies on your site. The problem is, on your hard drive, the problem is that the user may not know that the cookie's getting deposited or that these three different sites have a deal with DoubleClick.
Right, and what Diana mentioned earlier, too, is again, the potential aggregation through an Abacus and a DoubleClick.net, for example. You know, Abacus, for example, has what you buy at the grocery store. Okay, now they're going to aggregate that against everything you've done online, and they have a pretty significant amount of data on that. That's kind of scary.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, here's another. I mean, tell me if this aggravates you. People are selling your names all the time. Where's your commission on that, you know? I mean, I want some of that cash. I was reading some stats somewhere on what some of these mailing lists are worth and stuff. And like in the case of Toy Smart
was, a great example.
Yeah, it was like $15 million or something like that. You know, I'm thinking, well, how many customers do I have and what's my cut? You know, I mean, maybe if they said to you, we'll share your data, okay, but we'll give you a commission every time we share it.
Well, if you think about it, some people are doing that, though, right? Because the sites that say, hey, free internet access, just let us track your click stream everywhere you go. You know, then it's like, okay, you've bartered out your habits for the click
stream. I think the gentleman in the back had a question.
I'm sorry, yes.
Yeah, in regards to
good question. I think, you know, when it comes to personally identifiable information, there's an assumption that if you're providing what is defined as personally identifiable information, you are that person, because essentially you've given an identity out. But yeah, I mean, there still are issues of identity theft associated with that. And then there's, of course, the issue of non-repudiation. And I think that's always going to be an issue more than just privacy preferences, non-repudiation on the web is going to be an issue for a while. I mean, they can tie you to your credit card number and you tell them other things about you, and there's probably a reasonable assumption that it's you based on all these things. But, you know, is it truly non-repudiable? No. You know?
So, is it okay if we hold some of the questions? Okay. I don't mean to... We love questions, but we're just going to
keep moving.
Okay, why worry? Well, obviously your worry is people right now hearing about this, and that's not really a, that's an easy one, right? You personally as a consumer, okay. But why worry as a person in the corporate world? And if you're not in financial services or in healthcare, you may be going, hey, I'm out of here. You know, HIPAA and GLBA aren't going to apply to me because those are just in those industries. No, that's no one is safe. You're not safe out there. If you're doing security, security's going to be wrapped up in implementing privacy. These acts are far-reaching. They're stretching beyond just healthcare and financial services already. They're harbingers of society's desire. I mean, this is coming. You know, who knows who's next on the hit list, but it's not just going to be financial services and healthcare that are going to be regulated in this manner. So it's a good thing to know.
Well, if you have a website, you're subject to FTC scrutiny.
Already, yep.
Yeah, so...
The other reason to be concerned is that lawyers are starting to notice. And when the lawyers get involved, lawsuits occur, and that can be extremely expensive. I thought it was pretty interesting that the Association of Attorneys General, when they met on June 20th in Seattle, they had all their public sessions were based on, which is interesting, public, private, but anyway, they were all around privacy and litigation for privacy. So, I'd be concerned if I was an organization, a company that had any data stored at all about people. Why else should you worry? Well, consumers are worried. The numbers are pretty clear. We've got a lot of numbers up here that prove that the consumers and customers, they care about this. They don't want their information shared out. Do you have...
These are stats that we developed in forming our privacy position. And, you know, it is respect to healthcare. Property and casualty business, life insurance, and so on. And you could see that basically they trust us, okay, but they also place a high value on that information. So again, we've got to continue to keep the bar high and doing things that keep consumers from worrying about what the heck Nationwide, for example, or any company is doing with their data.
Yeah, and also something about as e-business expands and people have partners, your partner may be under some of these regulations, so you may have to adhere to the regulations. Or even something like EU, the data directive. There's a data directive in the European Union, and any company that's doing business with the EU does need to adhere to those regulations. So just not being in financial services and healthcare is not a...
And those are opt-in, by the way.
Yes, it is often, but the Europeans have a really interesting history that the Americans don't, and I think that's why the Europeans have a stronger privacy policy for it, because there was a time in Europe where records that were kept about your religious, your religion, what religion you believed in, were ways to find you and hunt you down and kill you. And that has not happened here in the U.S., and the Europeans are much more aware of privacy, and I think it's because they have a very recent tangible history that of how information about you personally can be abused. You want to talk about
that? Sure. Again, these are parts of surveys that we've conducted that are part of IBM Harris surveys that are on the Privacy in American Business website. It's a link in the back of one of the two presentations. What do consumers like? The convenience of the internet, right? The speed to which they can get stuff and see stuff that they want. They also like personalization, but they like anonymity. And those are kind of at odds with each other to a certain extent. You know, I want a personalized experience. Don't put cookies on my hard drive. Well, it's tough, you know. They want control over their personal data. You know, I want to be able to tell you what to do. They want explicit and clear privacy terms and conditions. Tell me what you're doing in simple English, not lawyerese, you know. They want to know that you're doing something. You know, for example, if it's a financial services website, they want to hear the security language in there that says, we use SSL, 128-bit encryption, blah, blah, blah. You know, even though we have no security policies and we have no security officer and our budget keeps getting cut, we're taking care of this, you know, that kind of thing. And you know, they want to see various mechanisms mentioned in some way, and I can't remember what I meant by data differentiation.
I have your note actually in front of me, and what you meant was, and it's a good point, some bits of data are more sensitive to people than others. For example, some people, you know, your height or your weight may be very, very sensitive data that you don't want to share. Social security numbers have recently come up as a real hot button for things that people don't want. So on the other hand, your name may be something that you're more than happy to share with everybody, or the fact that, you know, you like coon cats or something. So it really depends a lot on a, you know, what how much you value that data and its importance. What don't they like?
Oh, you want me to do this?
Yeah.
Okay, what don't they like? You sure this is mine? I think this is yours.
Okay, well, anything they can't get, right? That's what people hate that. If they don't understand it, they don't like it. So if you're making things difficult, or this opt-out thing, I don't know if it's inside the company, outside the company, you know, don't confuse people. They're not going to be happy with it. People really don't like things that get shared with third parties at all. If it's again, it's the same point that we heard earlier. Hey, if I'm trusting you as a business, I trusted you. That's okay. Whatever your policies are, I'm going to abide by, but you know, don't go sharing it with that other third party. Same as CVS. CVS, you can have my information, but don't go sharing it with a telemarketer. People don't like things that they didn't ask for most of the time. That's why push technology failed. Now, it's just, if you didn't ask for it, you tend not to want it. So don't send people junk mail automatically based on preferences. Don't send them the direct marketing stuff. They're not going to like it. What do consumers tend to worry about? These are the top three things. Who's seeing my data? What are they going to do with it? And when they find out it's wrong, they get very, very upset. So you want to be careful to protect those for the consumers in your company. And you know, what's interesting is that use and disclosure cover both authorized and unauthorized use of the data. So consumers are, you know, not only concerned about what's allowed, but also what could be misused. The corporations themselves, what are you guys probably worried about? You're worried about the acts themselves and how they're going to be regulated. The acts are federal. There are state regulations, too. The acts tend to be known as something called floors. So that's really a basis that you can adhere to. But the state acts tend to raise the bar a little bit. The international standards and data privacy standards are also big concerns.
Across the U.S. right now, there are 400 different pieces of privacy legislation under consideration, both at the state and federal level. So you can imagine the patchwork that you might wind up with. If you're a business that does business all over the country, you might have a problem on your hands if a couple of states decide to raise the bar, let's say to opt in, you know, where everything else is opt out. I mean, that would be a real drag. And there are states that have those kinds of laws under consideration. So far, they haven't gone anywhere, though.
Right. Yeah, basically privacy is going to be something that you need to implement in order to be a successful e-business. Customers are saying that they absolutely demand it. You can see a study appear from IBM. And also the FTC is starting to crack down very seriously on people adhering to their privacy policies.
I'll give you one case study on that. GeoCities, anyone heard what happened to them? Mm-hmm. And basically they published a privacy policy that said, you know, they do X with the data. They turned around and completely violated that policy. The FTC came after them, found that they were indeed, violating the use of information, you know, the appropriate uses of information, and put them under a consent decree. What that means is that whenever GeoCities wants to use their customer database, they have to get permission from the FTC before they can do it. Not a good place to be if you're a company in a .com world. So,
you want to talk about the Bancor, U.S. Bancor, the oversharing? They overshared.
Yeah, I mean, again, basically the issue is that it's funny. I'm on a steering committee for a privacy conference towards the end of the year, and all the people want to talk about in a steering committee are online privacy. It's like that's the only thing. I mean, I don't know where you guys keep your data, but at Nationwide, it's on mainframes. I mean, it's a back office processes. It's on big sunboxes, on Oracle tables, you know, and that stuff's not out on the internet. I mean, the internet doesn't even see half of that stuff. So the issue is that you can have a situation where there's conflicting conflicting objectives between online and offline policy, and you can say online, well, we're protecting your data, we're offline, you completely violate it out the back door. Can't do that. I mean, basically what you put on your website has to hold through from end to end in your company, and that was a point we faced at first. It was difficult. We went live with a site to sell insurance over the web in March, I think it was, and the people that were doing the website, they were like, okay, where's our privacy policy? They wrote this thing, the lawyers looked at it, it was really cool. And then I said, prove to me that this is what we're really doing with this information. Well, that's not my problem, they said. You know, on the website, we don't share it. Well, it goes into the same databases that the agents are operating against in their offices. You know, so I mean, we had inconsistencies there that needed to be reconciled. A lot of people in both the business and IT side don't understand that linkage. Anyway, people have gotten in trouble for stuff like that, and you'll continue to see that. Let me address this one too.
Yeah.
Have any of you seen these aggregators where basically they'll take, let's say, have an account at Chase and an account at Citibank and an account at Nationwide or Schwab? They'll aggregate all that data onto a single site for you. Basically, you disclose your user IDs and passwords to them, and they conduct screen scraping and basically aggregate all your financial data from different institutions. Well, here's the problem: are they a bank? No.
Screen scraping is they were going to the website and they were grabbing the data off of the site. That's known as screen scraping. It's usually applied to Kix on a mainframe,
right?
Getting data off behind a Kix region.
So how do you know who regulates that? Well, the OCC and the financial, you know, the Treasury type of things, FDIC and the Fed, they have no jurisdiction over these organizations, and the banks can't stop these people from doing it if the customer has given their user ID and password over. So what happens? So a lot of banks have actually published on their website notices right up there in your face that say, do not work with aggregators because of all these bad things. And now the aggregators are annoyed about it, and I think there's some lawsuits going back and forth. First Union is a case in point. We're going to see more and more issues about that. I mean, there's something called the Financial Services Roundtable, and they've actually had a forum recently on aggregators and how the heck should banks and other financial institutions deal with this threat to, well, probably their businesses in some respects, but I mean, customer privacy is what they're really concerned about, because what if the customer perceives that the bank is the one that's given away the information, even though they're the ones that gave away the user ID and password?
Yeah, well, I think it is very interesting. It begs the essential bottom line privacy question, which is, who owns the data? And if my data about my bank account is sitting at Fidelity or at Fleet Boston, but I want to give it to an aggregator, what right does Fleet have to not let me do that? But Fleet, because I see it as my data, I own it. But Fleet sees it as that they own it and they're providing a service to me. So it's going to be an interesting question. You know, who, we don't know who. Oh, okay. Yes.
The question. I would say, there's something you're presenting that I've run into a lot of the privacy policy consultants, where you have a statement and you have an option, sometimes the force out, and you have a statement, a privacy statement of your company and of your website, but then you buy lists from a third party, and since the individual did not give you the information, you have a totally different policy for what you do with the information that you bought. As far as the mailing list, you say, well, why did I get a mailing if I opted out? Because your sales department bought a list ahead of your meeting on another site.
That's a great point. He's bringing up, what if your policy is you allow your own customers to opt out so they don't get the mailing, but then your direct marketing department in your same company buys a list, and that customer happens to be on the list, and now you direct mail to them, and how you handle that.
A little bit. I'll just address it briefly. If it's a financial institution selling you the list, They can't do it anymore under GLB. I mean, that's a no-no, okay? Because it can't exchange that with non-affiliated third parties, okay? Right. 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 The issue would be, it would really boil down to, again, is there a regulatory environment that somehow governs that issue? In our case, for example, at Nationwide, we would not be able to do that, and we would not be able to treat those separately, because under GLB, insurance companies are required to call any personally identifiable information that we obtain. It now is a customer record, even if they don't own a product of ours.
So the definition of GLB is
right.
Yeah.
But we're from a risk management perspective, we're tending to look at it as something that we need to treat as if it's a customer. See?
Right. And that's good on your support. And then the next comment I want to make, which I didn't see in your presentation, is there's the CP exchange, which is the customer profile exchange standard that's going on. And if you read the prefix spec on that and for the privacy regulation from the FTC report, if I have a certain piece of information and I put a website that links to another website that has a different policy, then the aggregate screen now has customer profile, like for instance, lens tracker, knows what color eyes you have, because you fill it out on the website. But then you go someplace that has something about clothes and they say, well, oh, you like blue clothes because you have blue eyes, you look great with you. That really bothers a lot of people.
Sure.
But the individual is never identified on the website. The information was linked based on the different subsets, systems.
I mean, I guess the way we approach
this fellow was talking about aggregated data that isn't individually identifiable. So you as an anonymous user, or people are upset about having just the data aggregated, period.
See, I'm speaking for what I've done on this. I mean, we take a risk-averse approach on all of these kinds of things to the degree that we maintain some kind of positive control over it. So where we feel that in any way some strange usage of information would violate either regulatory guidance or our perception of what our customers expect based on the market research we've done, we stay away from it. Okay, but I'm sure that there are a lot of companies that would not have the same position on it. We discussed that a little later in the standpoint of what do you choose from a policy perspective. You know, obviously some companies are going to live on the edge. You know?
Yeah, and talking as a consultant, I never consulted to Nationwide, but I did consult to a bunch of banks right when they were trying to establish their privacy policies, and the first thing we tried to understand was how many people in the company touched a particular piece of data, and they couldn't tell us. They didn't know the flow through the company from a piece of data about an individual because the companies were so large. And the question of if the direct marketing group buys a list that has one of the customers on it, I think that's going to be extremely hard to legislate, because for that direct marketing company then to say, okay, let me make sure nobody on this list happens to me. Somebody could come along that's part of a bank and buy the list of the people who attended Black Hat, right, and mail to us. I mean, that's pretty common. You go to one of these shows, I don't know what Black Hat's policy is, but you know, I know RSA definitely resells their list. And is it going to be the company, the bank, do they have to say, well, I can't ever, you know, mail to somebody on this list that I got in a unique way? Yes.
I can't remember the names of them, but if you give me your card, I'll send you a list and a presentation I have on it.
So, oh, okay. More questions?
Where you can find
them. Okay, we also have a good list at the end, I guess, of the next presentation, the next after the break, of good places to go for information about privacy and things like that.
Public radio did a story.
Okay.
www.org.
So, the regulations themselves, and I'm going to hold the questions again, that's okay. The regulations themselves, do you need to plan for privacy? Yeah, you do. You need a plan. And again, no silver bullet. And I advocate a framework maybe because I'm a consultant, but I advocate a framework. Eddie's got a slightly different view. We're going to explain to you about how you can actually take this from the stuff we're going to present right now, which is all the techie stuff about what the regulations actually say. I've tried to interpret them for you and bring those down into something that you can actually implement. The way to do that, I think, is to really start with a matrix. You've got a lot of regulations. We talked about, 400 different pending privacy regulations right now. There are a lot of constraints. You're going to have federal, state, foreign regulations are going to be there. So consumer needs and some consumer wants, you got to start marking this out in a framework and getting in a matrix and getting an idea of what applies and how. And we've done some tiny little matrices in here for you to take a look at. What is a regulatory requirement? I don't know if anybody knows. I when I first started thinking about this stuff years ago, I wasn't clear on it. It's when a government, a state, or the state or federal, enacts a set of constraints on an industry. So basically, they're saying you can or you can't do this. That's what's happening. Privacy legislation is not new, just as privacy invasion is not new. Privacy legislation is not new. There was a Privacy Act back in 1974. Fair Credit Reporting Act, which people may know. That's when people take a look at your credit. Has anybody here ever seen their own credit report? Was it? Okay, that's good. How many people here, same group of people that raised your hands before, how many people here, was it accurate? Yeah, that percentage went way down because your credit reporting tends to be pretty inaccurate. So that was brought into case so people could go against and say, hey, this isn't right about me. Because this information is used to get you other loans, other credit, mortgages, things like that. So it's important. There was law on access to video rental. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but there was actually a case where a government worker's video rental history was brought out and displayed to people, and he had rented a bunch of porno films, and that was actually against his platform, and it was not a good thing. So after that, there was a law on access to video rental, which was enacted, and there's also the FDIC's FIL, which bases its privacy around websites.
There's also a lot of case law supported by Clarence Thomas on that issue.
Yeah, I know. See, I was going to bring up the Thomas thing. Yeah, that's right, because we couldn't get Thomas's video rentals. Yeah. Okay. Would have been interesting, though, during the hearing. It's not just the United States. It is the big guys, EU Data Directive. It went into effect October 25th, 1998, and there's a lot of stuff around the Data Directive. I tried to give everybody just a tiny little bit of information around it so that you could get a sense of what it is. But it's basically protecting privacy. It is being legislated, and they are... I'm taking people to court for failure to implement it. And actually, Sweden took, I can't remember which airline, to court for it because the airline had not erased the personal data within 24 hours of a flight. And that's seen as a violation of the data directive. So they're actually out there. They're implementing and they're enforcing. If you do business with a company in the EU, your company, if you have data and you're doing business with if you either have data about a European national or you're doing business in that country, you need to adhere to the data directive. Citibank actually put up a different processing center in North Dakota so that they could process credit card transactions because the processing was so different for the European versus the American.
And they actually have German auditors that come over from Europe to audit that data center against these European data protection directives.
And you don't want to mess with a German auditor. Oh yeah, and of course, blame Canada, but Canada's going to jump on the bandwagon too. So, and yes. Oh, thank you. Yes. This slide has been updated. The legislation has been passed in Canada as of early February. Thank you.
Second part of the question has to do with the EU directive. I know that the Canadian legislation
you want to feel safer?
Yeah, it was a drag. You can imagine for the negotiators that they work out this deal, and then it goes to the parliament and it blows up basically. Some of the articles I read on that said that some people obviously weren't concerned about their political futures, that basically decided that this deal that had been in the works for a couple of years blew up. I'm not really sure where that's going to go. We have used the safe harbor principles as sort of a set of guiding principles in how we do business overseas. I will tell you that the philosophy that we're using is that the bar we need to set is the European Data Privacy Directive. And because we do business in Canada, you know, we do business all over Europe, and it kind of constrains. Just imagine, like, let's say you have a business in Poland, you know, which is a difficult environment in which to do IT today, and you know, you want to have some redundancy somewhere for that business in terms of, you know, the infrastructure and so on. It's logical for us to bring it back to the U.S. if we can. In order to do that, we need to meet all of the European regulations. Once you get into that game and you look across your, you know, your various business units, you suddenly realize that you just have to play at that level. But, you know, ultimately, safe harbor would be a good thing if it comes to pass, because it would at least give U.S. companies a model set of practices and procedures that they can follow that the Europeans would find acceptable. But for now, what you are relegated to do is follow the general guidelines of the Data Privacy Directive, and then in individual companies deal with the specific issues associated with registering your company with the local data privacy registrar. So it's complicated. It's a patchwork still.
HIPAA and healthcare speak. Oh, I'm sorry. You have a question?
You've spoken so far about the liability of a company to its end users. What I haven't heard is how that is intervening for an ASP if it's not being used. Is that liability transferred from the ASP? Or is any liability the ASP would have to the company in the factors?
Question.
Yeah, that is a good question, and I don't know if you were in the talk earlier, right, on ASPs. Yeah, there's a lot of the liability stuff going. And again, we are not lawyers.
I mean, there's
liability is going to be very, very, very interesting to watch how that plays out. But there are not a lot of examples out there in cases that people have seen.
You know, the U.S. model for this kind of stuff is not to do a whole lot of regulation and letting the courts sort it out. And in my opinion, there is not sufficient case law on a lot of these issues that will come up, especially when they're applied against the new regulatory environment. But I mean, you can expect that most of the regulation pretty much gives consumers, individuals, the right to sue companies. And you can imagine both individual and class action lawsuits occurring. Time will tell where this lands us, you know. The companies today that are resisting regulation may in fact support it better when they see a lot of case law that's against, you know, their organizations.
I guess my concern is not so much from the point of view of how do you treat the data, how do you store the data. That's the case that everyone who's complied with the most stringent interest in renting forever. I think all of the lines of the opt-in and opt-out piece where one has got to leave it, in my mind, to the parent company.
Forcing compliance and being able to enforce compliance is going to be very hard, and then linking liability if there's a failure of compliance. It's not going to be easy. Okay. HIPAA and healthcare. HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, and Clinton signed it August 21st, 1966. There was a deadline in there that said that it had to be enacted for privacy legislation on August 21st, 1999. Missed the deadline. So the Department of Health and Human Services stepped in and said, okay, we'll do a federal privacy standard, and they did complete one on November 3rd, 1999. And that's posted, that's known as the NPRM. Anytime you post something like this, it's the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, NPRM. That's how this stuff goes through the government. people were allowed to, you can post public comments, because this is a democracy, you can post public comments on any NPRM that is available, not just HIPAA, and not just the privacy legislation in HIPAA. HIPAA has a lot of moving parts to it. It's not just about privacy, and in fact, there's legislation on privacy and on security in there, so it's a pretty complicated, yes, did you have something immediate?
Yeah, even though they can
Oh, HIPAA is an act that has to do with a variety of different things. One portion of the Administrative Simplification Act part of HIPAA is where the privacy comes in. So privacy in HIPAA is just a tiny part of the overall act. And the privacy and security regulations are just a tiny piece of it. For the privacy standards.
Well, the issue is that HHS released these draft regulations in November. There was a comment period. They got so many comments, which you'll see in a second, that basically they've gone back and are trying to figure out how to reconcile all these comments into some kind of, actual final rule, as it's called.
But is there any standard for the healthcare industry at this point?
No. There is no final ruling.
I mean, there's prior stuff. You know, like those regulations are associated with accreditation of health organizations, have certain requirements regarding confidentiality of patient records, but it's not as comprehensive as the HIPAA stuff.
And this is federal again. Your state, you know, your mileage may vary. Your state may be different because states do have their own state regulations. So this is just the federal. And again, this is privacy and security. HIPAA is big. But yeah, you can read the public comments. I advise you to read them. There are a lot of them. They're not all quite as entertaining. Many of them are as syntactically challenged, though, as this one is. And I've got the URL up there where you can go and read the public comments if you're, and you probably already read that. So anyway.
No, but I have a question about that, though. HIPAA is supposed to be protecting privacy.
HIPAA is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. There is a portion of HIPAA. So it dealt with a lot of what HIPAA was around when Clinton brought it in as an act is about being able to protect people's ability to have health insurance as and with when they leave companies. And also for people's insurance information to not be splattered all over the world when and if they leave companies. So if I am at one company and I am being treated for depression, then depression's a good one, or AIDS, you know, I'm being treated for something that's sensitive, and I go to a new company, how many people are going to see that information as also my medical care is still protected as I go from one company to another. And that's why it's portability. And people often think the P in HIPAA is privacy. It's portability.
Oh, they were just objecting to the regulation in general. It looks like, I mean, there are people who believe that, you know, especially constitutional law people believe that everything we need is already there. You know, we don't need anything to bolster the First Amendment, you know, in terms of free speech.
Right.
We don't need, you know, anything to bolster the Fourth Amendment, you know. I mean, and certainly there are a lot of companies that take that to heart as well. You know, don't regulate us, we'll self-regulate.
Yeah, and I just put that comment up as an example of some of the interesting comments you can see, but yeah. So, to answer your question, the final rules are in flux. It's very hard if you're a healthcare company. It's very hard if you're an insurance company, I'm sure. I don't envy your job, Eddie, because they are in flux. It's very hard to
get. We don't know where the bar is going to be, so we're just setting it really high and hoping for the best.
This woman is saying that she's understanding that the final proposed rule is the right bar, and so you're working to that, right? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, well, I can tell you that as a common sense person, that makes a lot of sense to me. But I will tell you that we've got a lot of business people in the organization that are hoping that based on a lot of comments that they've read, that bar gets lowered too. So you see what I'm saying? I mean, it makes a lot of sense to think that way, and that's how I think. But we've got business people on the other side that have developed a business model that they can you know, go a long way with if that bar is lowered a little bit from where it is. So,
yeah, it is. It's, there's a security piece attached to HIPAA that can't actually go for final ruling until after the privacy piece. So folks are waiting for that as the second portion coming along. And again, there's some wait and delay. I actually heard somebody say that he thought that HIPAA was going to get thrown out completely ultimately because of all of these delays. Although I don't think that's going to happen. I'm not going to take that bet. Yes, they do. They do. And there are some reference sites either at the end of my slide set or the next slide set we'll do. And I think it's in the book, your book, too. You can go to, if you've got the handouts, there are listings in there. I'm going to sort of scoot along over I go into depth here about what is covered. If you want to get a little bit deeper into it, to what the rules do, what's covered, to explain to people, you know, what HIPAA actually applies to, it's when the information becomes electronic, but it protects I like this term, the paper progeny. So if you print it out, it's still protected. There are different rights and policies associated with it that you guys can read along. Based on those two, I came out with this. This is actually the important slide here. Here's an example, and this is a very little requirements matrix. This is just the beginning of what you're going to need to do as you start to impose these in your company with the policy elements. But going through and saying, okay, what were requirements in HIPAA? Well, patient access rights, is that part of security and privacy? Right now it is. Confidentiality policies is part of both of them. And then privacy itself does require things like a privacy officer, patient access to logs, and health information use and disclosure. So as you start to go through the policies themselves, sort out what the different elements are that you will have to adhere to, and then begin to see where they fall under which parts of the requirements. Okay, do you want to talk about FS or you want me to?
No, it's fine.
Okay. I've just been yapping for a while.
Yeah, that's fine. GLB, as it's lovingly known in our organization, last year signed. We thought we were going to have to implement it by November 13th of this year. They've given a reprieve to financial institutions, and I think we have till July something of next year. But we're actually going to meet the November deadline just because we started down that path, and there it is.
Yeah, financial services was a lot more efficient. I don't know if they learned from what happened in healthcare, but yeah, it's moved a lot more quickly.
Well, once you get people excited about it, too, you know, you want to keep that momentum going. I mean, just to mail out the privacy notice is going to cost us $2 million, just to give you an example. So, anyway,
And Graham Leach again is another. It's a big act. It's very far-reaching, and it's Title V of that act, which deals with privacy. It is not just a privacy act.
Right. There are sections that deal with privacy. There are sections that deal with the security aspects. Just looking at what we need to cover since we're at it. Okay. The main requirements here is the same stuff we've been talking about all along. You need to have accurate and conspicuous privacy statements. You need to provide a notice to the customers annually of what your privacy policy is and so on. You need to provide them the ability to opt out of any sharing of their data. Of course, there are loopholes through opt out because there are ways that we need to use information that are exempt from the opt out requirement. You know, for example, it's hard to issue a certain kind of account if you don't have a social security number, for example.
Yeah, I mean, the bottom lines with GLBA is that you have to notify your customer when they come to you what your policies are. You have to update them about once a year, and it has to be written clearly. And you cannot share their information with third-party, non-affiliated members, and they have the ability to opt out of your sharing policies.
There's a section of the GLB 501B that basically addresses some of the security-related requirements, and basically you're talking there about a standard of due care. Fed and the FDIC, OCC, OTS, all those regulatory agencies released a paper for comment recently that contains an actual description of the desired security mechanisms, the policy, and you know what actually security is going to look like. We'll talk about that a little more in the second half of the presentation. But if any of you are involved with insurance companies, financial services organizations, you need to look at that because that's the bar to which you're going to be held accountable theoretically if those those draft rules actually make it into some kind of final rule.
We have till 10 past. Yeah, and that stuff is available. That is on your links at the end there. They're very long. They're very dry. Some of these documents are, you know, hundreds of pages long, but they're certainly worth it if you're in the field and you're going to need to apply these. This is just a cheat sheet. Anyway, so again, you know, here's again breaking out policy elements that are part of GLBA and their privacy. So impacts. This is Eddie's quote. He likes this quote. Impacts. What's gonna happen? What if you don't do it? In other words, you know, you're gonna get sent to your room without dessert. What's gonna happen?
Monica Lewinsky is a case study in invasion of privacy in a lot of ways. If you look at it, there's actually a book. I think it's a Sykes book, The End of Privacy. That actually it started to write it based on the on Monica Lewinsky's story and turned it into a privacy paper as it started to think about it a bit more.
Which that was a nasty case because, you know, they went into her hard drive and undeleted files. I don't know if you guys know that, but they actually part of what they got was that they undeleted files that she had deleted on her hard drive that were personal private files, and that writing little journal entries basically about what she thought about the president, and they went in, got her hard drive, and she didn't know about PGP and WIPE, I guess.
Well, I mean, if you think of the origins of, you know, so, I mean, the watershed in terms of privacy doctrine is the Brandeis right to be let alone. And basically the reason that he got involved in the whole privacy concept, I mean, this was, I think, in 1890-something, was because in a newspaper, somebody had written a story with details of, like, some party that his daughter had or something like that. And he just objected to personal information about his daughter and some party she had being published in all the newspapers. And so he became a privacy advocate and actually sort of started some of the key thinking on this whole privacy issue. Monica's sort of in the same boat.
So, yes, there is. We've already covered that there's going to be some regulatory impact. There are some fines applied to those. We didn't mention them, but there's some very high fines that are going to be associated with not keeping within the regulatory and legal force enforcements. But there's other impact, too, that you should think about if you're not going to be a good privacy citizen at your company. As Eddie said when he went into Nationwide, your brand name is on the line. And you don't want to lose that. There are financial impacts just around if your company is misusing the data or not adhering to privacy. And also there are some failure consequences that I see. We're going to talk about these in more depth. Yeah. But we still have a little bit.
Okay.
Yeah, we have until 10 past.
Questions?
Oh, you want questions?
Well, I don't know.
Should we open this for questions for the next five minutes before the end of the, or do you want to hear us talk about the impacts in detail? Don't all shout at once. Are there questions?
You talked about this.
Yes.
Can you briefly comment on the position a company might want to take when they go through a merger, when they have to?
Oh, wait, hold on a sec. Before you guys leave, this is only the first half of this talk, so if you're brave-hearted, come back at 4:30. We're going to be talking for another hour about privacy, but we're going to be talking about actually implementing and how you get the framework and the technology side.
The real stuff.
The real stuff.
Yeah, like mergers and acquisitions, for example. We have a template that we use for security due diligence, whether we do it ourselves or we do it with, some audit firm or something like that. We are building right now a privacy template, and it obviously just mirrors our regulatory stance, mirrors our company stance, and then we do some due diligence. See,
most of the room are security professionals. When you're in a company and you get bought by somebody, and they come in and they have a different security policy stance than you have, you want to protect your position.
Right, but keep in mind, if you get bought by somebody, you may not be calling the shots either. You know, I mean, we acquire some companies and we have direct control over what happens in the next steps after we buy them. But frankly, you know, we buy some companies that we're told, this company, leave them alone because they're doing fine the way they are. And
regulatory where, like in the FTC case, where you want to mix the data between the two, where from the merger,
Sure. I mean, be subject to obviously a lot of due diligence and consideration. Some of it is cut and dried. I think some of it's going to have to be, again, risk management positions.
And sometimes the government gets involved. I mean, they certainly did when Travelers and Citi wanted to go together. I mean, that was the government crawled through their books and really told them, this is how this is going to happen, and it's not going to happen any other way.
Any other questions? Yep.
Yes.
I mean, let's put it this way, there's going to be some consumer backlash, right? But, you know, a lot of this stuff exists in gray areas from a regulatory perspective. And, you know, luckily, I mean, you've got Robert Petofsky of the FTC, who is a real privacy advocate. And he, you know, tends to go after companies. But, you know, right now, I mean, really, that's what you're talking about. If the FTC takes interest in it, great, but if it doesn't fall within any of the regulatory frameworks that we talked about earlier, you know, you're SOL, I mean, in some cases, and you just got to live with it.
Yeah, in some cases, it does go back to McNeely's quote of, you know, you have zero privacy, so it is a risk.
A little bit different question. Do credit card companies normally sell all their data? As I just read my American Express, and they sold the data,
It is the information gravy train. Your information, they're not selling all your data. I mean, they're not selling, probably not, your actual buying habits, but they're selling your name and your address, yeah. Yes, and most credit card companies do that.
And there are a lot of loopholes under FCRA, Fair Credit Reporting Act, that actually governs some of what happens with respect to privacy in that space. There are a lot of loopholes. I mean, I don't know how many dollars of credit you all get offered every week, but, you know, I think one week I was up to $380,000 of credit that I was offered, you know, in between home equity loans and everything else. What amazed me about some of the offers is they very accurately knew how much I owed. And the loan value was really close to everything I owed that month, if you know what I mean, in terms of total
380 value?
That wasn't that much. If it were that one and I could sign it and go up somewhere, I might do it. But, I mean, you know, how do they get that info? Well, it's a loophole in FCRA. I mean, that's how they can do it. Just like, you know, I don't know if you ever tried this, but you can obtain credit reports on other people if you want to.
It's entertaining. So, yes, we'll be here to answer questions, and we'll be back at 4:30, so we hope you'll come back. We'll be talking about technology.
Thank you.
Thank you.